Welcome to the Room for Debate podcast. I'm Vikas Bajaj, member of the New York Times editorial board. Is the American economy destined to grow at a much slower pace than it did in the past? That's one of the most contentious questions in economics today. In his book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth, Robert Gordon makes the case that living standards in the United States are likely to be stagnant for the next several decades and are unlikely to match the increases seen between 1920 and 1970, a period he calls the golden age of growth. In the Times Book Review last month, Paul Krugman, the economist and Times columnist, called Gordon's book a magisterial combination of deep technological history, vivid portraits of daily life over the past six generations, and careful economic analysis. Many economists and other scholars strongly disagree with Gordon's forecast and say America and the rest of the world can and will grow much faster than he suggests, especially if political leaders adopt the right economic policies. In a recent column in the Boston Globe, Jeffrey Sachs wrote, "Fatalism is misguided. Long-term economic improvement occurs when societies invest adequately in their future." We will discuss the future of the American economy with Bob Gordon, who's a professor at Northwestern University, and Jeff Sachs, who's a director at the Earth Institute at Columbia University and a professor there. Let's start with you, Bob Gordon. It is clear that growth rate of the economy and living standards went down markedly since 1970, though there was a notable increase in growth in the 1990s. What caused that slowdown, and why do you think it will continue?
We have to take a broader perspective. For more than a millennium between the Roman Empire and the 18th century, there was very little growth at all. The best estimates for Britain, which has the best statistics, is that from 1300 to the year 1700, growth was occurring at only a rate of about 0.2% per person per year. And that rate would require 350 years for the standard of living to double. After the late 18th century, we got the first industrial revolution with steam, cotton mills, railroads, and steamships. And then beginning right after the American Civil War came the second industrial revolution with a broad range of very different powerful inventions, including electricity, the internal combustion engine, the panoply of entertainment and communications inventions, including the phone, the phonograph, the radio, motion pictures, and then later television, as well as such byproducts of daily life as central heating, running water, indoor bathrooms. And life had changed overnight between, say, 1890 and 1940 in urban America. Just to be there in the teens, you witnessed the number of automobiles in the United States going from 800,000 to 9 million just in one decade. So it was a period of tremendous change that went up through 1970. After 1970, it's not that we stopped inventing things, but the scope of invention narrowed down to information and communications technology as well as entertainment. And the broad range of human activities, including food, clothing, where we bought it, housing and its equipment, the way the kitchen operated was pretty much the same by 1960 or 1970 as it is today, with the single exception of the microwave oven. In the period since 1970, the big developments have been the computer, starting with the mainframe. Then in 1980, the personal computer with spreadsheet and word processing software, and then moving on into the 1990s with the internet, search engines, e-commerce, and flat screens. And that all did make a one-time only jump in the level of business productivity as we moved each office from paper and file cabinets to a world of flat screens and search engines. But that transition pretty much was over by about 10 years ago. And our productivity growth, the sense of change in the way things are done has slowed down. If you look then over the broad range of years back to 1970, we've had a really good decade in the late 90s and early 2000s. But most of the rest of the last 45 years, we've seen productivity growth at a slower pace, about half the pace of the 50 years in the middle of the 20th century prior to 1970. There are good reasons to think that the late 1990s were unusual and will not happen again. And so I'm looking out over the next 25 years, seeing productivity growth, not at zero, not even at 1%, but at something like 1.2%, not that different than it's been in the last decade.
Jeff?
Well, first, I think Bob's book on this topic is absolutely phenomenal. So everybody has to read it, study it, and debate it. And I've certainly assigned it to my students as well. And I think there's a lot of rich discussion here. But I would say that on this question of the slowdown, the big question that should be asked is whether the slowdown reflects a kind of exhaustion of technological possibilities, as Bob is saying, or reflects other aspects of public policy and the economy. And I would go more with the latter view than the former view. I think we have a continuing remarkable advance of both scientific knowledge and technology, and with the right kinds of policies, the growth slowdown that we've experienced would not have occurred. What do I have in mind? Well, after the 1970s, especially starting with the 1980s, we've been in a long period where government has been under assault. The main policy instrument has been tax cuts. And the result is that what the government did from World War II to the federal highway investments to the space shot of the 1960s, the moonshot, we have really pulled back significantly on the big national investments that make for the bold growth and the bold dynamics that Bob writes about so compellingly. So I don't think we have lost the technological possibilities for rapid economic progress. I think we're just choosing not to take them. We see it in budget cuts in crucial areas like research and development, public investments in infrastructure. It's not that we lack the technology to have fast rail in the United States. All over the world, there's better transport. We have just chosen not to pursue that. When we look at our infrastructure, whether it's the highways or the airports or the dams and levees, we're basically falling apart in this country because we're not making the investments. And it's not for want of big technological advances. So here's where I would part company. I think Bob's analysis that there has been a growth slowdown is absolutely right. The notion that there was that period from the 1920s through 1970 that he writes about as a golden age is right. But he also notes that World War II was, quote, the most important contributor to that golden age. And I would reinterpret that as saying that there was a massive national saving and investment, a huge buildup of our capital stock, which took promising technologies from the 1920s and put them into operation. We have those promising technologies today all over the scientific landscape and the technological landscape, but we're not putting them into operation right now. That, I think, is a matter of national choice and strategy rather than a kind of inevitable side effect of what Bob just called the narrowing of technological advance.
Bob, do you want to quickly respond?
Yeah, I partly agree in that we certainly could use more investment in infrastructure, particularly in repairing roads. But I keep emphasizing that the opportunity for investment was greater at some periods in the past, and Jeff's reference to the interstate highway system as a massive national investment in transportation is a great example of that. We don't need to build the whole interstate highway system again. Much of it goes through rural areas where there's very little traffic and congestion, and there isn't any room to build 8- and 16-lane highways where 4- and 6-lane highways are currently congested. So there's a limit to dealing with our congestion problems with more roads. We can adapt policies such as congestion taxes and tolls, especially in the electronic age where it's much more easy to collect them. Unlike Jeff, I'm a big skeptic about high-speed rail in the United States. I think our country is not sufficiently densely populated to make that feasible outside the Northeast. And we could certainly stand some more investment in the Northeast, but I'd like the Northeastern residents to pay for that, not the rest of the country that doesn't need it.
I might say, as a Northeasterner, by the way, I could only agree that we need it here. I would also say in California, there's absolutely scope for fast rail and some other parts of the country as well. The fact that we don't do it, putting aside who pays for it, is really an example of the failure of the United States to modernize the way that we used to. And I think that it is a reflection of this broader syndrome that we just don't invest in our future adequately.
5 or 10 years ago, few people expected that cars would drive themselves. Now Google has a fleet of self-driving vehicles in California and elsewhere. Many companies say fully self-driving cars could be available to people to buy in 5 or 10 years. Couldn't a major leap in artificial intelligence and robotics in the next 20 years prove you wrong, Bob?
I think that we want to start with robots and remind ourselves that the first industrial robot was installed by General Motors in 1961, which is well over 50 years ago. Robots have very slowly made their way into manufacturing. By 20 years ago, robots dominated the paint shops and automobile factories and were replacing one human worker after another. But this is a span of 50 years. My own forecasts for the future only go 25 years out, and I'm humble enough to confess that I don't have any idea what's going to happen at more than 25 years out. But I expect, given the achievements that robots have made so far, that we'll see a very slow, incremental arrival of robots. They're already in the Amazon warehouse, but they're only capable of picking up the shelves and moving the shelves to the human worker who picks out the object and packs it. So that even today, the robots are only taking over part of what the humans are doing, and we're seeing more humans working with robots rather than being replaced by them. Artificial intelligence is a little further along, and in some areas like law firms, we have the task of legal discovery of finding the precedents for a given case taken over by artificial intelligence computers and creating unemployment for many young lawyers. The last place a young person should be staking his future and going into debt is in the legal profession. So we have artificial intelligence getting into the area of personal financial advice with so-called robo-advisors. These things are happening, but they're happening very slowly. And remember, I'm forecasting 1.2% rate of growth, which isn't that different from most of the last 45 years. And we've had plenty of innovation, and there's room for plenty more.
Jeff?
I think that artificial intelligence is a huge deal. And that it is coming fast, and we're going to be seeing amazing breakthroughs. If I just think of the scientific journals of recent weeks, one article described how a machine learning process allowed an artificial intelligence computer system to master a whole set of video games. It wasn't even told, the computer wasn't exactly told what these video games were about, but it was given the final score and it figured out how to play all of these games. And then, of course, more recently, the breakthrough of the computer beating the Go champion. Go is the complex game that was considered to be so much harder than chess to model in artificial intelligence, and yet there's clearly been an incredible breakthrough of that system. Watson winning Jeopardy, and then IBM's Watson system being turned over to medical diagnostics is yet another example of this. I think language recognition, language translation, pattern recognition will transform massively the economy in future years. Of course, as I was saying earlier, how much of the economy is transformed depends on the pace of investment and how much public investment is made in these areas. You think about the semiconductor industry that transformed the economy after the 1950s.
The first buyer of the semiconductors overwhelmingly was NASA for the moonshot in the 1960s. If we have the national will, we'll tremendously speed up the development and applications of artificial technology. Bob said something that is both right, but I think also really needs to be rethought in a way. And he said that already the smart machines for legal research are causing unemployment. What I think ultimately we have the chance for is a massive rise of desirable leisure. Of course, if the machines are smart and if they can take over a lot of the activities that humans now occupy, the downside is that could leave a lot of people unemployed and in desperate shape. But if you think about it another way, if we consciously deploy these technologies in a fair way, then what it could make possible is a lot more leisure time. One of the interesting things in Bob's 200-year study of the U.S. is that despite the massive increase of well-being and the decline of arduous labor, the amount of work time has not gone down all that much. And one of the big breakthroughs in the coming 50 years could be a breakthrough to high-quality leisure. And that would be a kind of economic progress, even if it's not properly measured in the way that we measure GDP right now. And that's something that artificial intelligence could absolutely make possible. But we'd have to think about it, organize for it, deploy for it, plan for it.
I might add that in a number of the topics that we wanted to discuss here, it's useful to compare us to other nations. And the United States is an outlier in the lack of leisure in contrast to countries like Germany and France, where five-week vacations have been standard for decades. It's not necessarily that our additional leisure has to take the form of a decline in the length of the work week. It could take the form of a decline in the number of weeks per year that people work. It is amazing that the 40-hour week or 37.5-hour week has remained more or less unchanged since 1950 in the midst of all the progress that we've made.
And Bob, I think it does point out that, again, I keep emphasizing that we have choices to make, not inevitable outcomes. And the fact that other countries have taken these gains in more leisure, I think, shows the kind of economic progress we could still have in the United States if we choose to take it.
Bob Gordon, towards the end of your book, you list four forces that you say will be headwinds for growth: rising inequality, educational attainment is not increasing as it once did, people are working less because the baby boomers are retiring, and the federal debt is becoming unsustainable. Economists, including Jeff, have offered various ideas to address these problems: higher taxes on top earners for inequality, for example, more support for higher education and pre-K. Jeff, is Bob being too pessimistic about our ability to deal with these headwinds?
I think these headwinds, again, that Bob points out are real. I would add a fifth one, which is that the environmental challenge means that we can't go on growing as we have in the past. We have to change the nature of technology and the nature of our energy sector, for example. So the headwinds are real, but what they do point out in my mind is the need for new solutions. And the solutions that are on offer politically in the United States right now are not solutions. Virtually all of the politicians, aside from Bernie Sanders, say tax cuts, and tax cuts aren't going to do it. Tax cuts are going to amplify the problem of negative net government saving and overall low national net saving. They're going to exacerbate inequalities. They're not going to address the problems of aging adequately, and they will underfund education. So the headwinds are real, but they, to my mind, pose the real political problem of how, as a country, will we respond? And maybe if you're a betting person, then you would side with Bob in being pessimistic about overcoming that. That's fair enough, by the way. But if you're looking at it, again, not from the question of a bet, but from the question of asking, is this inevitable that we have a slowdown in the rate of progress of real economic well-being? My answer is no, it's not inevitable at all. We have massive areas where we could have improvements in the quality of life, where we could narrow income inequalities, and where we could face the fiscal challenges.
Bob?
Well, I have a range of policy suggestions, and they're not all coming from one end of the political spectrum, but a range of them. Just to mention some things that have support, broad bipartisan support, we have the incredible excess of incarceration of people, putting people in prison in the United States. If you look at Western Europe, the typical number of people in prison per 100,000 population ranges from 70 to 120. In the United States, that number is 700, more than seven times as much. The need to shorten prison sentences, the need to legalize certainly marijuana, if not all drugs, would eliminate the curse that afflicts many of our young people, particularly African Americans, who spend some of their youth in prison and then are stamped with the criminal record that hurts them from making progress in life. Another area where there's broad bipartisan support is by getting rid of tax loopholes, what Martin Feldstein, a Republican economist, calls tax expenditures. We could gain a lot of revenue and start to deal with Jeff's problem of negative national saving or negative government saving by collecting revenue. I see three different areas to collect revenue to send the government, the federal government, from a perpetual deficit into a surplus and give it the room to address some of our social problems. They are the tax loophole route, the Bernie Sanders route of at least to some extent, not perhaps as much as he suggests, having additional high level tax brackets for those making more than $1 million and more than $10 million dollars a year. And then there is revenue to be gained by introducing a carbon tax, which Jeff knows a lot about and can talk about if he wishes, to deal with global warming and environmental problems. Taking a government that would have that additional revenue, you then would be able to start thinking more broadly about social problems. I think there's a very strong need for preschool education that's not just at age four or even age three, but I think we need to go even younger for the poverty population and set up what essentially are universal nursery schools in areas where young people, often growing up with a single mother, are tremendously handicapped in the vocabulary they bring with them to school.
Jeff, I presume you agree with a lot of this.
Well, these are all very good ideas. And I think what they would make possible is really an accelerated development and deployment of the good things that we could be doing. What I think is notable right now, and I really feel it when I read the science journals each week, say Science Magazine or Nature Magazine, we're really in a kind of explosion of knowledge across many different fields, in genomics, in energy systems, artificial intelligence. Yet what is very clear in history is that those advances of knowledge don't get turned into economic progress unless there's something more to it. Bob points to the odd fact that it was World War II that made the foundation for a lot of this golden age. It seems so ironic, but it was a period of massive national saving and massive national investment that brought a lot of the new technologies to bear and also developed some of the key technologies of the future, especially the nascent semiconductor technologies and computing. So if we had the national effort, and thank God not from a war, but from a peaceful desire to pick up once again on the idea of deploying knowledge and technology for betterment, there are so many areas of advance, and the ideas that Bob has just given of mobilizing more fiscal resources to do that, I think, is a big part of the story. because while we live in an age where we all seemingly always hear that it's the private entrepreneurs that have done all of it, the fact of the matter is that the government has had a crucial role in every major technology. And even when you have the iconic figures like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, the underlying technologies that made their advances possible, whether it was computing, semiconductors, Moore's Law, or the internet, had a very, very strong government role that pushed those technologies to the forefront.
I want to disagree about something here, because I see a very sharp difference between the revolution in business practices that I mentioned happened from 1980 to 2005 and shows up in the productivity statistics for a single decade between 1995 and 2005. I want to contrast that rapid changeover to what's been happening in the last 10 years. I think we really have reached diminishing returns in the application of computers to the kinds of things that people do every day in their offices. It was a monumental revolution to go from paper, ordinary typewriters, and file cabinets to a world of publication where what you write on your own word processor goes without retyping into the printing press, a revolution to go from paper catalogs and card catalogs to electronic catalogs that kept track of the inventory. I could go on with those. What I think is happening in the last 10 years, and Jeff points out the decline in net investment in the private sector, not just in the government. I think we have a chain of causation that doesn't just go from investment to productivity, but rather from innovation to investment. I think the fact that the impact of innovation has been less on business practices in the last decade is one of the reasons why corporations are sitting on $2 trillion of uninvested profits. We have in the United States, the envy of the rest of the world envies our venture capital industry that stands ready to finance any even half-baked idea. We have week after week these unicorn companies being floated on the stock market with valuations of more than $1 billion. I see plenty of ideas, plenty of venture capital, but the ideas just are not important enough to attract the corporate investment that would get this $2 trillion off the shelf and into the economy.
I'm glad we're getting to some of the differences because when you have an economy like ours, which is almost all service sector employment at this point, we're somewhere around 80% employment in the service economy, and where artificial intelligence can do a huge amount of work, at least in principle, that is being done in the service sector, whether it's in medical diagnostics or legal research or, heaven forbid, in my sector, in Bob's sector of economic research and so forth. To my mind, this is a phenomenal opportunity that lies ahead, not an end of or diminishing returns on resources, but really the vista that's going to come. And again, when one could view that as saying, oh my God, mass unemployment coming through artificial intelligence, I do think the biggest breakthrough in the coming decades would be, if we organize properly around it, would be the chance for more leisure and different pursuits of our lives, because a lot of what gets done now in standardized work doesn't have to be done that way anymore. And so I do think that there is an open question. Why do we see this slowdown? I view it as a lack of public will expressed in declining government action on almost any front right now. That's an open question. That's a hypothesis. But I do think that the scope for a massive real improvement in the quality of life, in the health that we could enjoy, in the pursuits that we could enjoy because we have been relieved of more drudgery through smart machines is vast.
I've heard enough of Jeff's optimism. I want to bring up something that we haven't talked about yet, and that has to do with the future of medicine, where a number of the optimists point to the progress in using genome-type research to cure future diseases. We in the United States have a life expectancy of birth of something like 78 years old. In Canada, it's 81. In Japan, it's 83. We're strangled by an incredibly inefficient medical care system, which is almost the laughingstock of the rest of the world, where we spend 17 or 18% of our GDP to achieve a life expectancy that's inferior to other countries. And Nobel Prize-winning Angus Deaton and his wife recently publicized something that's been in the statistics, and that is that for the white population, middle-aged men, mortality is actually going up, even though mortality is historically improved decade after decade. So life is not necessarily getting better for people in the middle years of the population. And I'm very pessimistic about changing this. Bernie Sanders wants a single-payer medical care system, but I think our set of incentives and institutions in our medical society run by private insurance companies makes a single-payer model impossibly expensive. It's already extremely expensive for the population over the age of 65.
Bob, I would agree with all of that except the final conclusion of pessimism. When you see that what we spend 18 or 19% of our GDP to achieve, other countries get even better at 10 to 12% of GDP, that should be a cause for great optimism, that that's almost the freest lunch that we could find. About $750 billion of saving through a rationalized health system. Of course, the vested interests, not the technological limits, are really the barrier there. But I don't think we should presume that $750 billion is going to be left on the table and that the vested interests will continue to be able to gobble all of it up.
There you go, being an optimist again. You think you can tackle those vested interests, all those insurance companies, all those prescription drug purveyors?
Well, I think one of our jobs is to say that there's nothing inevitable about it, that in fact we have good examples all over the world to show us the way forward.
Let me move to the concluding question I wanted to ask you. Bob, in your book and essays, you say that we should not be dismayed by your ultimate conclusion about growth. You argue that the slowdown in growth and living standards is natural and we shouldn't, and there are good reasons for it, the diminishing marginal returns, as you just described. Can you explain a bit more why you're not as worked up about your conclusion as some other people seem to be, including Jeff?
I go back to the basic idea that economic growth is not a steady process. We haven't had a history of century after century of progress at a rate of 2 or 3% a year as we did in the special century from 1870 to 1970. The fact that we can't achieve in an ongoing basis decade after decade those rates of growth shouldn't be an opportunity for despair, but one for realistic reassessment of what we can achieve. I think to pull together my different suggestions for raising government revenue with the suggestions that Jeff has made on infrastructure, that I've suggested about preschool education, another area where I think we should learn from other countries is the German-Austrian system of apprenticeships, which helps to develop skills in the blue-collar population and helps to bridge what I see as a disjoint production of college graduates, many of whom cannot find jobs requiring a college education while we have shortages of high-skilled blue-collar workers. I think there are lots of things that we can do. Jeff's mentioned some of them and I've mentioned others, but we should do that within the context that we're dealing with a more slowly growing economic pie. And it's going to be more contentious to see how we divide up that pie.
I think one of the important points that Bob makes in his wonderful book is the difference of measured growth, according to gross domestic product, and progress in well-being. And he points out how in many ways well-being grew even faster than measured GDP growth by making jobs less arduous, less painful, and many, many other examples of better health and longevity and so forth, not necessarily captured by the GDP number. If you ask, is it crucial that measured GDP grow rapidly, I would start by cautioning that measured GDP growth is not really what we're after. We're after improvements of human well-being. If one says, well, should we settle with kind of stagnation of well-being, I would say no. There's no reason to. We're still on the cusp of massive improvements of knowledge that allow us to enjoy betterment in the quality of our lives. This is especially true, of course, in poor countries, but it remains true in the United States as well. So I don't see any cause for complacency. I think we should work hard, and Bob points out a lot of ways to do it, to measure what we're after more effectively. But then to say that we've run out of the possibilities of improving well-being, I think is not right. I think we could have more quality time for our lives. We could direct our days towards things that we would find absolutely more valuable, more enlightening, more meaningful. If we deploy the technologies in the right way, it's absolutely essential, by the way, that we move to new, more advanced, low-carbon energy systems. Otherwise, we're really going to wreck the planet through climate change. And when it comes to areas like healthcare, we know that, in fact, the news, ironically, is good news. Our system is so messed up that we have some huge, huge gains that we could enjoy through better social organization. So in all of this fantastic history that Bob has given us, I agree with him on the fact that history doesn't prove one way or another that progress moves at an even rate. But I do feel that we have ahead of us vast potential for meaningful, serious, large-scale improvements of human well-being, and that it remains our choice to take them.
If I may close this off with a thought that where Jeff and I both agree, it's that I wish the American political scene would take more seriously the lessons that we have to learn from other countries. I've mentioned the German apprenticeship program. You could go to almost any of the developed countries and improve the American medical care system by imitating what others do. The Canadians have a very different system of immigration based on education and qualifications that we could be well served to adapt. We haven't mentioned the ultimate solution to a problem of an aging population, and that is lift the roof on immigration and let anybody come in who has a minimum level of education and skills. The Canadians do a better job in financing higher education than we do, with much lower tuition and much less student debt. So I think that there's a lot of room to change American institutions, and we have a lot to learn from other countries. And on that, I think there's a potential for optimism until one actually starts listening to the political speeches that we hear every day.
In fact, quite the opposite. Marco Rubio warned us that, oh my word, we might look like some other countries. In fact, he warned us four times in a few minutes. But I think that the real fact is that there is an enormous amount that we can learn, just like you say, from others, as others have learned from us at different periods. That is a reason for optimism that we both share.
Well, thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks a lot.
So, did we change how you think about this topic? Tell us what you think at nytimes.com/roomfordebate. For The New York Times, I'm Vikas Bajaj.